The first thing that I think about is I don't look at investing as a way to get rich. I look at it as a way of staying rich. So like investing is a great way of storing wealth and preserving its value and compounding its value over time. But you shouldn't look at it as a way of making money in the first place.
This week, I'm sharing the second part of my conversation with Rob Dix, who is a co-founder of Property Hub and the co-host of The Property Podcast, which is one of the biggest business podcasts in the UK. And Rob is also the author of three popular books about property and investing, including The Price of Money, which was a Sunday Times bestseller. Now, in this part, you're going to hear Rob and I talking about the secrets of wise investing. We also talk about investing in stocks, how to choose the right investments. We talk about the role of Bitcoin and gold in wealth preservation, and whether or not you should prioritize earning more over saving more. And finally, we talk about the importance of financial discipline. So you can get the full show notes, the transcript, and read my newsletter at theknowledge.io. And you can find Rob on Twitter and LinkedIn at Rob Dix, and his website is propertyhub.net. Now, if you love this episode, please do share it with a friend. And don't forget to leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts, because it helps us tremendously to find other listeners just like you. During that same period, you also saw lots of startups blow up, but because they were investing in crazy stuff. So, you know, maybe you have people that are investing their company, they're investing in Bitcoin, or they're investing in other cryptocurrencies, which blow up overnight, or they're investing in crypto funds, or they're investing in lots of different things that all of a sudden could go up in flames. And that creates a lot of knock-on effects. It creates a lot of problems. But historically, bonds are supposed to be safe. And so now we have this problem. And I'd love to know how you reconcile this, where, okay, we've said you shouldn't hold your money in cash because that's not safe, because inflation is going to be higher than whatever you're getting from your bank, especially if it's not in a savings account. If it's just in your current account, your checking account, you're getting nothing. And so you're losing money just by holding it there. Then potentially there's some risk even in bonds, because what happens, I mean, unless it's like a US government bond, even then, you know, what happens if the yield curve inverts or something like that? You know, bonds have some risk, even though they're presented as being the least risky thing. And then, of course, equities as well. Equities can also be risky, where you're essentially investing in the stocks of companies. Something could happen to a stock overnight that is completely random, seems almost unrelated. I can imagine, for example, if you were a shareholder in Adidas, when suddenly Kanye West starts saying some random stuff. Day to day, he feels very unconnected from the company, but actually the Yeezys that he makes make a lot of money from the company. You might have been investing in Adidas for completely different reasons, or you're invested in a fund that holds Adidas stock, and then suddenly it all goes down because, you know, someone over here said something that people don't like. So it's crazy that there's a lot of places you could put your money that all seem volatile in their different ways.
Yeah. And that's it. They are all volatile in their different ways. And so the first thing that I think about is I don't look at investing as a way to get rich. I look at it as a way of staying rich. So like investing is a great way of storing wealth and preserving its value and compounding its value over time. But you shouldn't look at it as a way of making money in the first place. So if you start trying to chase returns and you start trying to make the highest return possible, that leads you towards riskier investments. You're investing in some kind of weird coin that like someone's told you on Twitter is going to blow up or whatever, and but you don't really know, or like you take a punt on one particular company because you believe something's going to play out. Like it can work, but it could also not work, and it can be significant. So if you're instead in like focusing on earning, and that's where your attention is, then you're ultimately going to do far better. And you've got control over that. You've got control over your earnings in a sort of way you don't with your investments. But then with investing, what you said was that they're all risky in their own way. And that's completely right. But if you combine a lot of different types of investment, then they're all risky in different ways. And so generally speaking, if you diversify as widely as you possibly can, then you're spreading your risk out across lots of different things. So like the obvious example is, well, say you invest in Adidas and something random happens, but if you invested in 100 different companies or 1,000 different companies, then doesn't make so much difference because another company will have a good day and it will average itself out. But then if all of those companies are in the US, then the US could have an issue compared to the rest of the world. So you diversify out further and go, okay, well, I'm going to own companies spread across the whole world. But then, like, something can shake the whole market in general, and the whole of equities everywhere can have a bad time. So that's when you want to be holding something like bonds that are supposed to move inversely. I question whether they do, but at least they're generally not subject to the same forces at the same time. You can own things like gold that in theory will do better when there's uncertainty. You can have assets that do well when there's inflation. You can have assets that do well when there's deflation. Basically, if you own a whole bit of everything, some of it, they'll all do well at different times and under different conditions. So on the whole, it all averages itself out. So I think really that's the best most of us can hope for is just go, I don't know, I'm just going to have all of it.
So a quick one I wanted to ask on that, actually, because, you know, it will partly be useful for me, but I think it'll also be useful for a lot of people listening. Is there any particular way that you think about investing in equities in general? So speaking specifically about this asset class, just because I've taken a lesson in the last few years from investing, I definitely tried to diversify my investing. So as much as I gave added as an example, I only invest in funds that have loads of stocks. I couldn't tell you what all the constituent parts are, but I do check sometimes and I have a vague idea of, okay, this is the split between different geographies and different sectors, different industries, etc. But this kind of ties back to what we were talking about, where there was one fund, just a Vanguard fund that I was invested in, that because I'm in the UK, it's largely UK denominated. And it's just been, it hasn't been terrible. It's actually done okay. But compared to then, I was looking at like a US version that's pretty similar, but a lot more weighted towards the US or a lot more weighted towards the rest of the world. Then suddenly there's a drastic difference in the outcomes, because as much as I thought this had gone well over the past, let's say, 5+ years, because the UK economy hasn't been doing that great, suddenly I'm leaving a lot of returns on the table. So even though I've got this diversified fund I'm investing in, it still is maybe diversified in the wrong ways relative to how well the economy's done. So is there any way that you think about that?
Well, the way that I would look at that is that that is almost an inevitable consequence of diversifying, that you'll always be able to look at things that have done better. Because if you could pick the best, and you knew in advance that it was going to be the best, obviously you'd do that. But then by diversifying, you're deliberately saying, well, I don't know. And so if you'd invested like 100% in the S&P 500 in the US over the last 20 years, it's like beaten the hell out of everything. And that's largely driven by a few big companies. So if you'd known that, yeah, of course you'd do that. But the trouble is, people assume that the future is going to keep on looking like the past, and it's not. So just because the US has dominated for the last 20 years, it doesn't mean it is for the next 20. It's probably making it less likely that it's going to dominate for the next 20. So you can take the opposite view and you could go, well, actually, the UK is looking cheap right now. If you look at the relative valuations of the two, UK companies look cheap, especially outside the FTSE 100. Therefore, I'm going to invest in that because then it's got, if everything reverts to the mean, it's got a higher chance of going up. But that could be wrong. So then you go, well, actually, maybe I should just diversify and have a bit of everything. It's almost like you have to come to terms with it. Like if you're making the active decision that you don't know, then you're always going to be able to looking around and going, oh, I wish I'd invested in that. But what you have to ask yourself is like, well, would I have invested in that really? Like, did I know that that was going to be the winner, or would I have just been lucky? So that's something that I like to do is I take 90% of my portfolio and I just spread it as widely as I possibly can. And I go like, I don't have a clue. And then I keep 10% of my portfolio to just do random stuff with, to get things out of my system. Because then it feels like if I think I'm a genius because I've spotted this thing that's going to do really well, then I get to do that. And sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm wrong. Normally I'm wrong, but it doesn't matter because it's only 10%. But that gives me my like an outlet. It's like a pressure release valve to go and like feel like I'm having fun with this kind of thing. Because it sounds like you're similar to me in that like you actually enjoy this stuff. Most people don't. But if you do, then there's always the temptation to fiddle and try and be clever. But I restrict that, so I still get to have my fun. But it's like, it doesn't blow up my portfolio if I'm wrong.
Yeah, exactly. I'd love to know, I mean, for clarity, this is not financial advice for anyone listening, but what's in your 10% right now?
Oh man, I can't even remember. This is the thing. I go through phases of being like, or like getting interested. And this is why I can't do it properly, because I go through phases of being interested and then get busy with other stuff and completely forget about it. But I've got a few random companies where it's just like, I have not done my research, but based on a little bit I know, I think it's going to do all right. And I can't think of an example. And I have had companies that have literally gone to zero before. So I've had others that will do okay. And then I've got others where it's like Japanese equities. So it's just like, to me, it seems like they're ludicrously cheap. And at some point, it's going to sort itself out and they will go up. Might be wrong. I don't have the macroeconomic knowledge to have a view about this where I'm going to like go and take a big gamble, but it's just stuff like that. And it's the same principle I take to crypto. Like I really believe in Bitcoin, the technology. I think it's really interesting, but I think there are risks that I don't quite believe in, like the whole it's impossible for the government to shut it down argument. I think they could. So that's why I'll happily go like sort of 5-10% in that, because then I think there's more upside than downside and it'll do well. But if it doesn't and it does go to zero, then it's not the end of the world.
Yeah, I think that's also another great segue, because you mentioned gold before and you were talking about thinking of your investments as stores of wealth. And obviously that's something that people talk a lot about, both with gold and with Bitcoin. I think you also own a bit of gold. So I'd love to know how you think about those two things and the balance between them. Gold seems like, especially in today's day and age, most places don't even take cash anymore. So we've moved very far away from actually having any gold coins. I don't remember the last time I saw some gold. And so why is that something people might still consider? And is Bitcoin a serious alternative to that?
The thing about both Bitcoin and gold is that the things have value from being scarce. So if there's a limited quantity of something and that something is worth having, that kind of puts a floor under its value. So the thing, great thing about Bitcoin is that the supply is fixed, or it's on a certain schedule. You know what the cap's going to be and roughly when it's going to be reached. So that means that no one can just go and like double the quantity and therefore dilute the value of it. And so if that thing is worth having because you can trade with people believe in it, whatever, then you know that it's going to be worth something. Gold is the same. Like there's only so much gold you can pull out of the ground. So like, unless an asteroid crashes into Earth and it's got a load of gold in it, the supply isn't going to grow by more than about 2% per year. The interesting thing about both of those is that, well, you can't really do anything with gold. Like there is some industrial use, but its only purpose is to be a store of wealth. And it's largely the same for Bitcoin. Like you can build transaction layers on top of it. And that's really interesting. And I think there could be a use for that. But essentially, it's a store of value thing. It's like people hold it because they believe in it and they know that other people believe in it. That's basically the point. And gold has been fulfilling that function for thousands of years. And so that's why, even though you can't do anything with it, it costs you money to store it. It's of no practical use. It's like something you're, at least I know that as long as, like, it's the whole thing, like the longer something's been around for, the longer it's likely to be around for. So it's like, well, people have valued it for thousands of years. Therefore, if everything went horribly wrong, I'd probably be able to trade with people and get what I want. The distinction there is between assets like that and just cash like denominated in some government issued currency, because the government can go and boost the money supply by 20% in a year. Done it recently. So they can just go and print more money. And with the more money that gets printed, the more units of something that there are, the less valuable each of those units becomes. So that's why there's always the potential for inflation eroding the value of your cash, but you're not going to have inflation eroding the value of your Bitcoin or your gold. The issue, of course, is that Bitcoin and gold don't pay you anything for holding them. So whereas if you've got like a property or a bond or something like that, it's actually of some use to someone. Therefore, someone will pay you for the use of that thing. Well, you don't get that with those. So if you stuck everything in gold, then you're not going to lose anything over a long enough period of time, but it doesn't pay you anything either. So that's why I'm drawn to property and do the podcast about it and everything else, because it's ticking a lot of boxes for me. It's a hard asset. There's a fixed quantity. You can't double the quantity of it overnight. It pays you an income and it's of actual real value to someone. It's not because it's never going to be worth nothing, because people always need somewhere to live. I still diversify. I still invest in a bit of everything, but I got the majority in property because it ticks so many of the boxes for me.
Hey, we'll get back to the episode in just one moment, but I wanted to tell you very quickly about my newsletter. I started sharing everything I was learning online and a few thousand people came along for the ride. I send 3 regular emails. Brainwave, fortnightly on a Tuesday, which is about the intersection between technology, philosophy, and psychology. Then every week on a Thursday, I send Revelations, and that's about creativity and productivity.
And then finally, every other weekend, I send Wayfinder, and that's about decision making. So people in the audience actually send me really tough problems that they're working through, and I help to deconstruct them using mental models and decision-making frameworks. So if you'd like to subscribe, you can join me and over 20,000 incredibly driven people at theknowledge.io. Okay, back to the episode.
In your book, you talk about this idea of prioritizing earning more over saving more. And I think that connects to what you were just saying in terms of the way you think about your investments. They are really about preserving wealth rather than ways to make wealth. So I'd love to know more about how you think about making wealth and how you earn more in the first place.
Yeah, I'm working on this for my next book at the moment. So I think it's something that's really overlooked because it's hard to give generalized information about. It's very easy, like most books go on and on about saving because it's very easy to give people five practical tips to save money and it's pretty much the same for everyone and you know it's going to work. But when it comes to earning more, there's just a million different ways of doing it. But when you start talking about earning more, then it naturally guides you towards entrepreneurship. Like that's the way for most people to sort of like generate serious wealth is through ownership of a business because it's got so much embedded leverage. It's not like you turning up for work every day and you have to be there or you don't get paid and you can't have 10 of you turn up because there's only one of you. If you've got a business and it's doing something that people want, then you can be spending the same amount of time on it, but you've got 100 people working on this thing. Therefore, you're producing that result for more people. Therefore, the business is more valuable. So if you want to like know, well, how do I get £100 million? The answer is going to be start a business. It doesn't mean you're going to be able to do that. Most people won't, but it's the only way you can do it. You can't do it by getting a high paying job. You can't do it by investing really cleverly. It's basically the only answer. So that's naturally where earning more guides you. But having a job is kind of underrated. Like people look down on having a job, but you can have very highly paid careers and you can be strategic about your career as well. I think mistake that a lot of people seem to make is that they just almost like let their career happen to them and they hope they get a pay rise or they hope they get a promotion. But I think it's possible to be far more intentional about it, whether that's by like deliberately applying for new jobs every couple of years, paying companies off against each other and trying to like maximize what you can get, developing skills that you believe are going to be in demand and are going to give yourself more, and just generally like making yourself invaluable, because companies, as a general rule, are going to pay you as little as they can because I'm like, oh, capitalism's evil, but it's just kind of, it's just how it works. And so, but like we've got people in our business who we would not want to lose under any circumstances. And so we'll pay them very well and treat them very well because we do not want them to go elsewhere. And so that's something you can do. You have the ability to do that. And so obviously I'm pro entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship's like, it's the sexy thing and it's great, but it's not necessarily for everyone. And so there are other ways of doing it. So by focusing on earning, you could spend, if you took the same amount of time that you would like faffing around with an investment portfolio, call it like 5 hours a week or something, and put that 5 hours a week into like developing a new skill or something like that, that'll allow you to earn more in the future. That's ultimately going to be a far bigger payoff.
I think I'm kind of 50-50. Well, I'm not really 50-50. I'm 100-100. So on the side of entrepreneurship, I am 100% agree. I definitely think that's great. It's pretty much what I do now and couldn't agree more. You build skills, you invest in skills. They're a way of investing yourself so that, you know, whether you also have a job or you don't, it gives you a ton of optionality that at any point, you know, I've built lots of different businesses in the last, you know, 10 to 15 years or so, and they can all be different, but you retain the same skill set. So no matter what it is that you're working on, you can always apply yourself to something new. And it's hard to, you know, you could have a job and then get fired. But as an entrepreneur, if you've built the skills of entrepreneurship, your business could crash and that could go away. So it's not to say that it makes you, you know, immune to economic conditions. But if you build that skill set and you build the know-how, you build connections, then you can start a new thing and you have something that you can take with you in a sense. So I'd say that one pushback I would have, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, just in terms of, I'm thinking about this within the context of having a job, kind of the balance between, okay, earning more versus saving more. And loads of people that I know say, oh my gosh, like you should only focus on earning more. And a lot of them already earn a decent amount. And I think that's great. But I think the issue, this is again, just me personally, I don't think most people save enough. I don't even think most people know how to save that well. Not that everyone should squeeze themselves to the final day unnecessarily, but I think that is also a skill, in my view. And I think learning how to squeeze your finances very tightly and manage everything, at least for a few months, if not a year or a few years, for me has been invaluable. And I'm so glad that early in my career, I learned how to do that. Because now later in my career, I don't always have to do that. And now, like, I don't have necessarily always have a month-to-month budget where I'm specifically counting each pennies. But when I do have to crunch things, I really can. And I can give you some examples. So in terms of the saving thing, I remember, and this is one example of like the earning more versus saving more. I remember, so this is when I first started training at a corporate law firm, and I was talking with one of the other trainees that came from quite a wealthy background. So they had like a house in the country with stables and all that kind of stuff. And I remember one day, you know, you come in and you're having a chat, and they happen to have bought a boat over the weekend. And obviously that is not the average life for most people. And I remember asking them like how much they save each month. And he saved half as much as I did. And I got paid so much less. He didn't necessarily know that, but so much less that it would be almost embarrassing to say. But I was saving twice as much, which is insane. And I don't even know how that's possible, but it seems to be a recurring thing. I know lots of people that earn over six figures a year and they tell me how much they save. And I just say like, where's the rest of it? Like, what happened there? And so I think that's part of the problem. You have this lifestyle inflation where if you never learned how to manage money in an efficient way, or I think your framing of what efficient saving looks like and efficient money management looks like scales up and down based on like what's the lowest that you've had to do it at. So if you think, oh my gosh, I'm really squeezing myself, but you're going to eat at like fancy restaurants only four times a month instead of, you know, every other night, then that feels like, oh, tremendous financial hardship. Whereas for another person, it might not. So yeah, I'd love to know what you think about that. And okay, the other example I was going to give you of how that has then been useful for me personally is that, so obviously I was kind of playing like this mental game of how much I can save as a proportion of like total income. So maybe you start from, I don't know, 5 or 10% that you can save, and then you keep going up. It goes to 30%, it goes to 50, 60%. And then on the side of working, I was also then running some businesses. And so even in my previous job, at one point I got to 100% of my net income that I could save because I was also making money outside of work. And then I was like, oh, I could push that even more. Then can I make 100% of my gross income? And so now from the gross income that I'm not even receiving some of it, I can save that much as well. And so obviously that's completely outlandish to the average person. So I'm not saying that that is true. But the reason I bring it up is because I quit that job. And so suddenly my income went down by half, or, you know, slightly more than half. And so suddenly I'm in a position where if I had not learned how to manage my finances and stuff, it's great that the entrepreneurship gave me the optionality to then quit that job and only focus on what I want to do. But if I didn't previously learn how to manage my finances, I can't imagine the position I would be in if I was spending a lot of that money and now had to suddenly adjust my income by half.
So how do you think you do that? Because like my standard thought about how you do all this is like, well, what you do is you like put the basics of saving in place. And so like, do the 80-20 on it. So like all you've got a few big decisions that make up the most of the difference. You've sort of like, make sure you've got decent habits. Then you don't have to think about that anymore. Then you can like take what's left over and put it into investments. You don't have to think too much about the investments because it's a long-term thing. You don't have that much control over it anyway. So just go and invest and then put most of your time into earning. And I think that makes sense as a framework. But there's quite a big embedded assumption in the first place, which is, oh yeah, just like put basic savings habits in place. And I probably undervalue that because it comes easily to me. Like I'm like a natural saver. And I think a lot of this goes back to our childhood and all the rest of it and like what you're brought up with. So how do you think you could do that if it's not like your natural tendency and it's not just like, oh yeah, just go and do this? Like, do you think there is like a almost like ways of, I think people are struggling for practical tips. I think everyone kind of knows what you're meant to do, but it's almost like having to rewire your brain in a certain way to do it.
I definitely agree. I think for me, and again, I don't know how widely this will apply, but I think it might be more useful in my current situation because I'm not, like early in my career, I was rigidly, I had the budget, I had the spreadsheet, I had everything, you know, fastidiously managed. Whereas now I don't really, partly because I've learned to be decent at it. But I think one thing that has been consistent is I just save first. So whatever percentage you have decided that you're going to save, you just do that first and then you suffer with the rest. At least that's been my approach. So however ambitious you want to be with deciding how much you want to save, for me, it's just making sure that that goes out automatically and then you just pretend it doesn't exist and you never look at it ever again. And so either it goes into a savings account, or you can also set it up to go into an investment account. So the same thing happens with my investments. Usually you'll probably have to set up two different things. So one is going from your current account to the investment account and then setting up a separate automation for it to invest a particular amount in whatever funds you choose once the money arrives. So that's how I've done it, because then I don't have to think about it. And then what I think about is what's left in my account based on how ambitious I've been with how much I want to save. And then that's what I worry about. So now it's like, okay, this is the money I have left. Then I can figure out what to do with it. And then depending on how ambitious you've been, you can figure out if you need to budget or not. So some people from that remaining amount, they're going to go to, I don't know, like a fancy restaurant. They're going to spend half of it and they're going to say, oh my gosh, I can't pay my bills. But some people might be like, okay, it's kind of all right. I can manage it. So that's kind of what I do now, where from the remaining amount, then I just figure out how to use it. It never really goes down to absolute zero, but you know, I think that's how I think about it.
I think it makes a lot of sense. It's like, it goes back to rich dad, poor dad, pay yourself first. Like, it works, doesn't it? And it's like, it's making the decision when you're at your best. And like, that decision is then taken out of your hands and you're left to deal with the consequences, which I think is a smart way of doing it. Something else that I think about a lot is conscious spending, because whenever you're making a decision about spending money, you're saying that you're valuing the thing that you're spending money on more than you value the money. If you didn't believe that, you wouldn't be making the trade. So in a perfectly optimized world, you would be only making good decisions because you'd be thinking about everything and going, well, yeah, I'd rather have this than the money. But in practice, I think we're really bad at knowing what we want. And so it's like, well, do I really want this thing? Or am I just spending this because it used to make me happy and it doesn't make me happy anymore? It's just a habit. Am I doing it to impress someone else? Or am I doing it because it's what other people say will make me happy? Is there a load of spending that's just set up on autopilot and I've forgotten about it? I'm not even getting any benefit from that. That's going to be the case for almost everyone. I'm sure it is for me. So if you can like really be conscious about it and make that decision, just like for every bit of spending, like, does it actually make me happier? Do I value it more than the money? Then that should automatically lead to making better decisions. But of course, it does involve knowing what makes you happy, which is harder than it sounds.
One thing I did want to ask you, specifically because you're married, you have kids, a lot of people, the reality is they're not just making financial decisions for themselves. They have to make financial decisions with their family or on behalf of their family. And I think you've been married for something like 13, 14 years as well. So I'd love to know how you think about, you know, specifically, actually, one thing a lot of people struggle with these days, particularly, I think how people feel about money management has evolved, where people are now trying to figure out, okay, do I share an account with my partner? Do I not? How do I do that? And I think you share an account. So I'd love to know how you think about financial decisions in your household, what's worked, what maybe hasn't worked.
The trick here is pick the right partner. Like, if you get that right, everything's easy. And if you don't, then you've got problems. And a lot of that is about having alignment, because like, people are weird about money. Everyone's weird about money. Like I said, it goes back to childhood. And it's like, people are completely irrational about this. And you don't have to get into the psychology of why, but it's true. And so you want someone who's kind of wired in the same way as you are, but can also like similar enough, but different enough, I would say. So like, if you've got two people who are both like hyper frugal, then you're probably just going to like push each other to get more and more extreme. And you'll end up just like, I don't know, living in a box or something. But then if you've still got two big spenders, then that can be a problem as well. So you probably want people who you're going to just like push each other a little bit. Like, my wife pushes me a little bit more towards spending without going too far. And talking about it and like not being afraid to have conversations about money is the absolute key to the whole thing. I don't have a strong view about whether you should share accounts or not. I don't know if it matters. I'm sure different things will work for different people. But there are so many cases of people who are like deliberately hiding things about money from their partner, or they don't know anything about their partner's financial situation. I'm just not convinced that's healthy. I think it's such an important thing. Like, you spend most of your day working to get money. It's a pretty important topic. You might feel like it shouldn't be, but it is. So it's something that I do think you need to be able to talk about.
Do you have any way of thinking about your goals or what you're trying to achieve financially, whether that's in terms of saving or investing, or when you put all of these things together, I think that's another thing a lot of people struggle with, is trying to figure out like, what is it actually for? What do they actually want? We talked a bit earlier about, okay, I want to buy a house. I want to get on the housing ladder. Why do you want that? Because my granddad said so, or, you know, because I see people on Instagram and everyone has these things. And so I want these things. So I wonder how you think about that.
Well, this is the ultimate question, because the secret is, the ultimate secret, everyone wants more. Everyone, however much they've got, always wants more. And they always want roughly double what you've got now. And this has been true for me, and it's been true for everyone I've ever spoken to about this. It doesn't matter what your level of wealth is. You always go, if you've got a million, you go, if I just had 2 million, then that would be enough. At that point, I wouldn't have to worry about it anymore. I'd be satisfied at that point. Then you get to 2 and you want 4. And it's, but it literally scales up to billions, and it scales down to hundreds. It's crazy. So the ultimate secret is to try to break out of that. And because what you really want, like, have you read the book Die With Zero?
Yes. Yeah, I love that.
So that, I love that book. And I think it just, that it puts it in the best possible way, which is that whenever you're earning money, you're basically going, you're exchanging your time, you're exchanging your life energy to get money. Therefore, the correct way of doing things is to have, so like, work just enough that you can do all the things that you want to do. And then at the end of your life, die having spent everything, because that meant that you would have exchanged exactly the right amount of time and life energy for money. And it doesn't quite work out that neatly, but I think that's a really good way of looking at it. So the goal that I have is really simple. Like, the core goal is just like, I want enough money that I can do what I want to do and not have to think about money. But it also helps that, like, I enjoy doing the types of things that end up making money. I enjoy business and I enjoy investing. So you will end up like going off on side quests and like have, and like wanting to go and like make more money because it's fun. And like almost like the game of trying to do something is more important than the money itself. But that's what it's all about, really, when it comes down to it. It's just like, can I do what I want to do without worrying about this too much? And for me, if you get to that point, then you've won. You might go and create new extra goals after that, because it's so hard to break out of the cycle of I want more, 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 want more. But you kind of deep down know that you've won at that point.
So one of the last things I wanted to ask you was about mistakes. And so, funnily enough, so Charlie Munger talks about this idea of inversion. The phrase that he had was, you know, tell me where I'm going to die so I never go there. And it's this idea of, you know, instead of trying to be smart, trying not to be stupid. So I guess the two parts of that question that I wanted to ask you is, first of all, is there anything in retrospect that you, like a mistake that you made, or a war story of your own, or something that you've learned from? I think there's probably three types of mistakes. So one type of mistake is about the facts. So there's something you didn't know that you then learned afterwards. Another type of mistake is maybe one of emotion. So you knew what you should have done and you just didn't do it. And then the third is just a pure error. Like, all the facts were right there in front of you and you just did the wrong thing. So I'd love to know if there's something in those categories. And then the final part of that is just, are there any anti goals that you think people should have? Like, things that people should definitely avoid at all costs?
Really good questions. Hard to do justice to. I think that I've made like loads of mistakes, loads of investing mistakes. Like, we did a property development that we lost £1 million on. That wasn't great. And that was just like pure, just like thinking we knew more than we did, like, and getting outside of our area of expertise. I think if you can, the ideal is to learn from other people's mistakes. I find, at least for me, I can only learn from my own. So I have to make the mistake for myself. I can hear someone else talking about it, and I'm like, oh yeah, but it's different because of this reason I've just made up. So, like, I think the only way to go about it is to try to, similar to taking 10% of your portfolio and like putting it into fun stuff, just like do it at small enough stakes that you don't completely blow yourself up. So you get the lesson without having like absolutely ruined yourself over it. But yeah, I've invested in companies that have gone to zero. I've lost £1 million on a property development. I've made, every mistake there is, but that's okay. That's how you learn. And that's why, I don't know, maybe Charlie Munger had it all sorted out in his 30s, but by the time you get to 90 plus, then by that point, you've had the chance to observe a lot and make a lot of mistakes. And by that point, you've got it all figured out.
Okay, perfect. And is there anything specifically you'd say to avoid?
I'm big on reversible decisions. So I try to avoid anything that ties me into a particular course of action or a particular thing. So, because then if you know that you can go back on it and you can undo it, then nothing is that scary. So I think people obviously are scared about you've done, like quitting your job to do your own thing. That seems scary, but the truth of it is it's actually a reversible decision because you'll always be able to go back. You can always go back and get a job, and you'll probably have learned so much from doing your own thing that you can go back and get a better job and be in a better position. But people think about it as an irreversible decision. So I just try to avoid things that tie me in. That's the way I think about it.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please do stay tuned for more. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the podcast. And follow me on Twitter. Feel free to shoot me any thoughts. See you next time.